Hello, and welcome to episode 54 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Scheffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by my new principal, Andrew Jackson. As I've mentioned a couple times, I started at a new school, and I couldn't think of a better way to start my new journey than to sit down with the man who is now my boss, and in a lot of ways is the reason that I chose to change schools. Jackson and I talk about the importance of building a strong team, improving staff morale, the role of a principal in a school, the gap that funding causes in schools, reflection as a method of problem solving, and building relationships with your staff and peers and students. Before we get to this week's episode, I do want to let you know that we are starting the summer schedule of the Planning Period Podcast now, so we're going to go to every other week for episodes. So this episode is going to release on June 15th. We will not have an episode on the 22nd. We will have one on the 29th. ISTE will have just ended, and hopefully that will be my ISTE wrap-up with the people I'm going with to ISTE. And then every other week all through July and probably through the beginning of August, and around the middle or end of August, we'll get back on an every week schedule. But for now, sit back and enjoy episode 54 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Andrew Jackson. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Scheffler, and I am joined today by the man who is now my boss. I've mentioned on the show before that I'm changing schools, and I'm going to be at a middle school this coming school year, and I have been lucky enough to take a minute to sit down with my new principal, Andrew Jackson. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. I'm going to call you Jackson for probably this whole interview. I think that's what I'm going to go with.
That's completely fine. I also go by Cadillac, Jack Stone. I got a couple other names as well. My wife calls me some names I'd prefer not talk about, but Jackson works for me.
Seems fair. Could you, for my audience, give them a little idea of who you are, your history in education, and how you came to be where you are?
Sure. This is my 21st year in education. I spent 10 years in the instructional realm, teaching and a little bit of dean work before I became an AP. I spent 10 years as an AP, 7 in one district and 3 in another before I returned back to the district I'm in now. Being in education, it's always been, for me, a lifestyle, a way to give back. Public school education is the reason I've found whatever success people perceive. It's the only reason I am where I am today. I grew up in an environment with low social capital, low socioeconomics, and the true equalizer for me was public education. And when I happened to fall in to becoming a teacher, immediately it was life-changing. And so here I am 21 years later talking to you.
Yeah, that's cool. And now a principal. You just finished your first year. How was that?
Interesting. it was awesome. I have to say, I work at a great school, and I have the best team I've probably ever worked with. We all work well together. We have phenomenal teachers on this campus. Our students are great. But man, we faced a lot of unique challenges, from hurricanes to eclipses to plumbing issues. we faced them all, and we survived, so it was interesting.
Yeah, and there are, when you say plumbing issues, there's a lot of jokes to be made about the things that poop has done and hit the fan or gotten on your face or whatever may be the case.
Let me tell you, brother, it was a crappy situation. I'm not going to lie, I've probably touched more things that I shouldn't have, not realizing what I was touching at the time while eating a ham and cheese sandwich and talking to one of my APs. I've looked up.
It's just
up,
dirt. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, trust me, brother. It wasn't dirt. But, looking up into a leak coming from the ceiling with my mouth open because I'm going, oh, as it gently splashed all over my glasses and face. So,
those are the things they don't prepare you for in your master's program.
Absolutely not. I don't think there's any preparation for plumbing 101 I probably should have joined a technical college for that, but yeah, it was definitely an interesting year, and there were some crappy moments, but again, we made it, and I think we were pretty successful.
Well, and I think one of the things you touched on there is the quality of your team, and having personally experienced that today, just trying to get to lunch, how great this team is. Yes. You know, I'm on my way to lunch, I was driving my fiance's car, and it died. And four of your administrative team members showed up at the spot where my car was to help me push it up a hill and then try to jump it and waited until we figured out what was going on. And it's just, you know, it's such a great atmosphere and a great environment. And I think there's no way to get around the fact that you're one of the major reasons, if not the reason, that that team functions the way it does.
Well, yeah, I think you give me too much credit. You know, I came into a good situation. And I believe the team that I work with, their personalities haven't changed. Their desire to serve hasn't changed. I think maybe they've just been given a little bit more freedom to tap into their already God-given gifts. But thank you.
So you would say what is the value of the principle then? If you're, you know, whether it be false or true modesty or whatever the case may be, you do step into a situation where you have a team and you've had some team member changes. You've had some administrative changes as well. But what is it that you have done as the principal to allow that freedom, to allow that vision, whatever that may be?
Sure. I think for me, the most important thing I could do is sit down with them and find out a little bit about them, get to know them, try to identify what their strengths and weaknesses are, because we all have them. I have them. And then together, collectively, we kind of decide the why. What's our purpose? What's our mission? What's our vision at this school? And, you know, that gave everybody an opportunity to give their input on why we're here and why we work so hard every day. And that collective, collaborative discussion led to a unifying vision. So, you know, if you want to give me any credit, it's that I've pulled everybody together and asked them the question that every leader should be asking. And that's, why are we here? And, collectively, we identified why we're here. Our purpose specifically at this school is to be the top producer of high school-ready students in the state of Florida. It's measurable. You know, when I came to a middle school from 20 years of being in high school, you know, this was a different world for me. And so to sit down with them and ask them, so what's the purpose of middle school? Because I can tell you what I thought middle schools weren't doing when ninth graders came to high school. And collectively, we all said, you know, we should be preparing kids to be high school ready. And there are measures for that. And we've ranked ourselves. We've identified where we are in the state. And we've got some room to improve, but we're doing pretty good. And then beyond that, it's supporting the team. We are big on collaboration. We're big on debate. If I pose an idea, I don't want a bunch of head bobbing. Yes, we like that idea because we can yes that idea right off a cliff. You know, I ask for counterpoints. That was discussed as a group from day one, and it's part of our day-to-day operations. When somebody throws out an idea, let's look at the reasons why it won't work first. And once we've identified those and we've debated it out, we typically have a pretty good solution. We do a lot of our decision-making collectively. So all I really do is bring the team together and sometimes set a tone. There's been very few things that I've sat down and said, this is how we're going to do it. No, I did a couple, but for the most part, it's I'm thinking about this. What do you guys think? And I believe that that's created a sense of buy-in. I think people feel like they're trusted. And so that's my role. That's okay. My role here is to build the team.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like I said, it's definitely working, you know, from having not been here previously, but a lot of, you know, you hear about schools, you know how it goes when you're in, it's like you hear about other schools in the district. And I think that a lot of the outside perceptions of this school in particular have already changed in the last year, from what people will have said. I think when, you know, if you think about the end of last school year and people are like, oh yeah, I'm going there. There was like, ooh, okay, that's an interesting choice. And now it's, I said, you know, I would tell people, oh, that's where I'm going. They're like, oh, that's awesome. Like, it's a great, you know, everyone's excited about the things that are happening here. And there's a buzz. And I felt it even the last couple of days, the last few weeks when I've come here and there for a few minutes to, you know, the end of the school day or whatever. I feel it with the staff and with the teachers. There's a buzz. There's an energy in here.
Sure.
And I think it's, you know, it's an exciting prospect to get to work in a situation like that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it makes me feel good to hear you say that, because that's the intention, is to create a buzz. You know, education's a hard gig. The pay isn't very good. And, you know, I'm sure you notice every month. And the current social climate, people don't respect education as much as they really should, with legislation making decisions that make our job more difficult. You know, the entitlement of a lot of parents and students, where there's a different expectation on how we should perform. There's a lot of stressors on teachers and administrators to do everything. You know, we have to parent a child. We have to feed them. We have to make them safe. We still have to educate them. And then we have to respond to every email and every phone call, and we have to do it within 24 hours, you know? And really, it's a lot. It's a tough job. And so I believe the best way to mitigate the difficulties of the job is to really create a buzz, create an environment where people want to be. Education should be a lifestyle. It shouldn't be a job. If it's a job, you should probably look for a different, you know, field of work that pays better. You know, we get to do really cool stuff, and it's hard. But man, if we're not creating that environment, that buzz, if you will, that makes people excited to come to work, then we'll start losing teachers. We already got a teacher shortage already. So I want to keep my teachers, and I want people like you to want to come to my school. So we got to create that buzz.
Yeah, and I think you know, there's probably a million ways you're doing that, but one of the things that I've been really impressed with from a distance is some of the initiatives, and it's because it's something that's important to me as well, but some of the morale boost initiatives you're doing, some of the things you're doing to really honor your teachers and honor their work and their sacrifice that they give to be here every day. Can you just talk a little bit about some of those things you're doing? You know, I know you have like First Fridays and some other stuff like that. Sure. That is going on.
Yeah, you know, I identified pretty quickly through talking with the leadership team that the morale was relatively low here. And, you know, there's always a morale shift when there's a leadership change anyways. So we just threw out some ideas. I had some fortune before with some other previous principals that had really good rah-rah moments, if you will. And so we threw it out there that every Friday, first Friday of every month, we were going to cook pancakes for the staff in the morning. You know, each team, the leadership team, as far as the coaches and stuff, they had a week, and the deans did a week, the APs and myself, we did a week, guidance counselors did a week, or a day actually, first Friday of every month, like clockwork, we were out there cooking pancakes, and we tried to one up each other, you know, playing music, having a good time. You know, that was just one little thing that we do that's a low-cost thing that brings everybody together in more of a social environment. They see us serving them, cooking for them. You know, we've grilled out. We've done a lot of grilling out. We bought a grill, low-cost, buy hot dogs, buy chicken, things like that, and grill out for the teachers. We've done a lot more communal things instead of just something silly like buying lunch for the teachers for a holiday or teacher appreciation. We as a group collectively cooked for them. You know, we actually had our staff Thanksgiving luncheon. Instead of ordering just a bunch of food, we asked everybody to pitch in. And so, you know, the math department selected a food item like vegetables, and the social studies department did breads. And it's really cool when everybody contributes. It becomes more of a communal environment. People start to be interested in their fellow peers. You know, teachers hang out in silos a lot. And so this allowed them to, hey, what are you bringing? Oh, wow, your grandma's favorite bean salad. And then they taste it, and it's phenomenal. And now there's a personal connection. So we've done a lot of little things like that. Mostly, though, I think the thing we've done the most is empower teachers. We ask them early on, you know, to take chances in their classroom, to let them know that we were going to do work as hard as possible, to not be punitive. A lot of the information we provided them when we did classroom walkthroughs and observations, you know, we always gave them an opportunity to hear areas for growth, but we spend more time pointing out some of the things they're doing right. You know, a lot of times they hear all the time from parents and students and their peers what they're doing wrong. So we took a little bit extra effort this year to point out what they were doing right. We told every teacher at the winter holiday break, you know, our intention is every teacher come back. And you know, you have to put your money where your mouth is when you do that. So I think our teacher observations reflected it. And I think there's a sense of security that comes with hearing from not just the principal, but the APs. Hey, we want you back. We need you here. And if you're not successful, we're going to blame ourselves. It's our job to coach them up. So that's really all we've done. It's the culture and climate comes from the communication and letting them know we appreciate them, and then backing it up with a couple fun activities.
Cool.
Cornhole in the courtyard. That's even happened. So we're just trying to have fun, man.
Yeah. So you've kind of touched on, in describing your solutions and the things you've been doing, you've kind of touched on a bunch of different things that are problems across the board in education, I feel like. And so I think that lends itself nicely to my first go-to question, which for all of my guests is always, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Wow. You know, I'd love to say it's funding. And, you know, funding is obviously a barrier. I'd love to say it's the public buy-in for public education. You know, as charter schools and private schools and vouchers becomes more of a thing, I believe there to be an intentional, break or destruction, breaking down, taking apart, whatever the word is, of public education. You know, I'm a believer in competition. Competition's good. But competition on a level playing field is preferred. And, you know, private schools and charter schools get to operate outside of some of the rules that we're tied down to. But truly, I don't even think that's it. Right now, I believe you can not look at any school grade, but look at zip codes and socioeconomics. And you can grade a school based on the community and the socioeconomics around it. You know, zip code matters right now. And that's unfortunate that schools in a lower socioeconomic area, that they end up being DNF schools. Traditionally, the data is there to support it. Socioeconomics, obviously, is one of the biggest indicators of student success and performance. And so, you know, to me, the biggest struggle that schools are having right now is societal in nature. You know, having to teach a kid and get a kid to grow based on a metric that a legislator or somebody has put out there is completely fine. But when there's not a consideration of a fact that a kid hasn't eaten dinner, hasn't eaten lunch, hasn't eaten breakfast, a kid doesn't have a home to sleep in, or maybe they do have a home, but they don't have air conditioning. I don't know if you've ever tried to sleep in a home in Florida. You know, I know we're in your beautiful bunker here and it's freshly air conditioned, but, you know, there are a lot of obstacles that we face in education, and they're societal by nature. And I don't have a solution to those ills. You know, I take any kid that comes through the doors and we try to love them and we try to support them and keep them safe. And then we try to teach them and teach them to the best of our ability. But we get kids 7.5 hours a day and then they go out into the real world with not a lot of support. You know, parental support is lacking. You know, my wife and I, we both work. So our daughters see us less than the teachers see my kids, but my kids spend a lot of time, you know, not supervising maybe the way that would be best for them educationally. So even from an educated home, you know, we don't parent the way maybe kids experienced back then with social media and things like that take time away from kids and learning. But that's kind of a big roundabout way of saying that we got a lot of problems with public education, and there's not one area that I can identify. But, you know, funding is what it is. Public perception is what it is. But until society figures out how to close the financial gap between the rich and the poor, you know, it's just going to be the burden that we try to carry. And, you know, I'm living proof that public school can not just change a life, but change generations. You know, my kids have been on a college campus inside my wife's stomach. And the first time I really spent time on a college campus was the first day I walked onto a college campus as a freshman. So it was public school was what got me where it was. So we're the great equalizer. But in the meantime, it's a rough battle, brother.
So from a, it is. So you're dealing with, when you talk about zip codes and you talk about socioeconomics, there's also the, going back to the funding issue, the funding is also tied to property taxes, which in a lower socioeconomic area means it's lower. Mm-hmm. And so we are, that further compounds the issue that someone in a lower socioeconomic area, hypothetically, in many cases has less parental support or the support is not to the level that would be perfect or ideal or however you want to phrase that. But on top of that, that school receives less funding because in that area they don't receive as much because of their property taxes.
Well, that's in theory, that's correct. In the district we work in, there's an equitable distribution of money. And then, of course, most schools in lower socioeconomic areas in certain zip codes, they get Title I dollars. So mm-hmm. there is an influx of money to help mitigate some of those concerns. So in our district, the equitable division of money exists, and a lower socioeconomic zip code, the schools in that community, they're funded equally. I can't say that about all schools all across this great nation. I can't say that about all schools in Florida.
Yeah.
But in our district, that's not a barrier.
But we still show in our district the gap in school grades to a socioeconomic area.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But again, you know, I'll give you a scenario.
A kid that comes into our school, and our school is not in a lower socioeconomic zip code, but a kid that comes into our school, say, two grade levels behind, more than likely those kids, there's either a learning disability or there's just not a lot of parent support, but with encouragement and pushing by us, they have access to things like internet, things to do, what's the software we use? I think it's iReady. Mm-hmm. You know, they have access to those things at home, so we can close the gap. In a different zip code, mom may work the night shift. There may not be a dad at home, and so they're staying with grandma. They don't have internet, so they don't have access to some of the interventions that exist. And so what ends up happening at a school like ours, because a kid might be below grade level through good teaching, and, you know, teachers tend to want to teach in a different zip code that it might be perceived as easier. So you might have, I'm not, certainly not putting an indictment on teachers that teach at title schools, but you might have a little bit better teacher, a more engaged teacher that can specifically target an intervention. And then the kid's going to get that at home because it's been targeted and they have access to it, where at a title school, they may not. And so at the end of the year, we can close that gap at our school. But at a title school, the gap, if you can just maintain the gap.
Yeah. You know, or it widens often.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just you're trying not to lose ground anymore. And that's unfortunate because a kid that comes in a couple grade levels behind, you still got the same number of days, same number of hours to teach them. You got to get twice as much in there. And that, man, that's a tough battle to face.
How do we address it? I mean, I know you said you don't have a solution, but there has to be. One of the things I point to all the time is, you kind of mentioned it, is as a teacher, we tend to have our best teachers at the highest income schools. There are exceptions, certainly, but for the most part, great teachers don't typically stay at a Title I school or a low income school where there are other struggles, because the struggles of the students end up being on the teacher and they end up having to deal with them. So how do we maybe address that part of it? Or is there another part we can address there? What can we point to at least start in the right direction?
Well, in a utopian world,
I think we should extend the school year. Just by, 3 or 4 weeks, more instructional time is a greater opportunity to catch kids and engage kids. Another thing I think, I just shared about the equitable division of money. I think title schools should get the opportunity to have smaller class sizes than maybe my school. And the rationale behind that is simply for classroom management. For whatever reason, the data shows that at title schools, lower socioeconomic schools, there tends to be more behavior issues. Watching 22 kids on our campus and 22 kids at a title school, it might be tougher to manage 22 kids at a title school. So I think they should have the freedom and funding for smaller class sizes so it's easier to manage. There's other things, year-round school for title. One, you're going to get an opportunity to feed kids. I mentioned the time factor that we only get them 7.5 hours a day, 180 days out of the year. Well, equitably speaking, that's the same amount of time, but a kid who's 2 years behind needs more. And, I think that would be an awesome option. But the barrier there, it goes back to what I alluded to, which isn't the biggest barrier, but it's a barrier, and that's funding. Every decision I'm talking about costs money. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know how you recruit good teachers to a title school. I worked at a title school, by the way. Spent 3 years there, and we recruited the mess out of them and tried to create a great environment, but our turnover rate was higher. Mm-hmm. And
I did 4 years at a title in middle school, so I definitely know it as well.
And it's tough work, because people get into this business because they care about kids and they want to teach them. But when you spend out of 47 minutes in a class, 20 minutes trying to redirect behavior, so now you only got 20 minutes of instruction, that's lost teaching time. That's lost time for intervention. So I think a smaller class size and a longer school year would help.
It would be nice if, again, you're talking utopian, so funding aside, if you could extend the time. And I think you probably wouldn't, and when you first started to say looking at year-round school, I feel like you would get some pushback from parents and families. But I think, like you said, in a Title I area, that would be less pushback because a lot of those kids are only getting meals that are at school because they're able to get them for free. And I think giving that year round, because as well as I do, that our district has put a lot of effort into trying to get food to students during the summer, because we've all had that moment. If you've worked at title school, you've probably had this as well, where the last day of school, they're having double lunches because they don't know the next time they're going to get food. And I've seen that for sure. And I think that would be something you could possibly pull off in a sense. Again, funding issues being what they are, that would probably be your barrier. But I don't think you'd have as much of the community pushback that I kind of initially would think with a year-round schooling option.
Sure. Yeah, that's why I threw it out there. At a lot of title schools, childcare is expensive. Mm-hmm. There's a belief by a lot of teachers out there that parents just send their kids to school because, it's free babysitting and whatever education they get is a bonus. If we're going to close the gap, we have to do something different. In our district, there's been an increase in pay. It's like an additional $20,000 for teachers who teach at certain targeted title schools. And I find that to be an interesting approach, and I know they had a lot of people apply, but I worry about the long-term success of that, because what happens when that funding runs out? What do those teachers do? Mm-hmm. Now you have people who have built up capacity that can teach kids in a title school, and they've been through the battles, and then as soon as the money's out, what happens? Do we just have a massive flight of really good teachers back to easier schools? Because, as well as I do, teachers are free agents now. That's how I got you.
Yeah.
y'all can go anywhere you want at any time as long as there's a vacancy. And as long as we have a teacher shortage, we're always going to have vacancies. So, I think year-round school. I also think another thing that I was going to bring up is extending the school year for teachers. You know, it's something a lot of people don't realize is school's out, they get 2 days to wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
And then a week before school, they get a week of planning for an entire school year.
Yep. And then 4 teacher work days all year.
And you know, honestly, that it's almost absurd, that model, because the reality is as soon as school starts, teachers are teaching, you know, 6 periods out of the day. They get a 47-minute plan period, and depending on if it's elementary or high school or middle school or high school, they got, 45 minutes to an hour before school or 45 minutes after school, and that's it, man.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be really cool if we went to like 11 months, instead of a 10-month school year. So we had a couple weeks of, planning and working and coming up with good lessons and breaking down the data and looking at the standards, before school starts. And then at the end of the school year, you know, a reflection is a powerful thing. Let's take a look at our data and reflect on our success. And while it's fresh in our mind before we take a month break, let's come back together as a group and, you know, figure out what worked, what didn't work. And, you know, if we just added that component, I think we would have better teaching. Not that we have poor teaching now, but I think we could be more targeted in our approaches, especially to close the gap. But I don't know how you achieve that at a year-round school either. So
true. Huh. I like it. A lot of different ideas. I really appreciate that you're thinking outside the box so much, that you're really considering like, what if we did? I like that type of conversation. And I think adding an extra month for teachers would be interesting. I think it would be nice to spread that out so that you had it not just like an extra, like 2 weeks before school starts and 2 weeks after school starts, but then you still get the same 4 teacher work days all year. I think if you could give some of those teacher work days throughout the year, that would really be nice to give that time in process. So that you'd be able to stop and go, okay, wait, what are we doing now? Like how did this go? How did this really go? Cause you're right. That reflective component is so critical. And right now, in a lot of cases, honestly, it's on the teacher to do their own outside time to reflect on how it went.
Sure.
You know, there's just not enough time to do it.
Reflecting in isolation is great, you know, but reflecting with a group is even more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hadn't thought about it till you just brought it up, but you know, how about a week off every 9 weeks? You know, where we have a week of planning after the first 9 weeks, week of planning after the second 9 weeks. You know, you can look at data from the 9 weeks and then plan for the upcoming 9 weeks in a couple of days. I mean, that's more than we get now for an entire year. But, you know, I brought up reflection deliberately because I'm a believer in reflection. And, you know, I've asked my APs and a lot of teachers I talk to and to reflect on how they're perceived in the classroom, how lessons go. At the end of the 9 weeks, reflect on your grades. Are your grades, do they satisfy you? I had a mentor who brought up really early in my career the idea of reflecting on how you do. And I'm telling you, it's a powerful way to adjust without feeling bad. You know, a lot of times we face a lot of failure in education. And when you can reflect and recognize your intent was right, your intention was good, but the actual process maybe failed, you can identify more quickly where in the process it failed and stick with the intention. You know, it's kind of like why you come up with a vision for a school. You know, it guides you. But yeah, man, anything to improve the process and improve education, I'm for. But until legislation comes up with a different funding model and stuff like that, we are where we are, so we're trying to make the best of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's going to lend pretty well. You may have already, because you've hit on a lot in a very short amount of time. You've kind of hit a lot of topics, and I appreciate that.
Sorry if I'm talking too much.
No, you're good. That's the point. You're the guest. I just sit back and listen for the most part. That's kind of why I'm here. So, but I do want to ask my second question, which is, what is something you're doing you wish all educators would do?
All educators in leadership or all educators as teachers? Because, you know, there's some things we do collectively, and I think there's some things that truly are bifurcated, you know, in admin and the leadership component. So
let's go with teachers.
Okay.
Because I want to say, I like to focus on the connections between admin.
Well, you know, I challenged teachers at the beginning of the year. I told them that we're going to focus on R&D. You know, in the business world, it's research and development. But for me, it's relationships and data analysis. And the R part is foundationally what's most important. And I wish more teachers
felt comfortable or maybe enabled to connect with their kids more. You know, teachers, I feel like when I got here early on, every time I walked in a room, it seemed like they wanted to jump up and be teaching. But when I walked in, I was seeing good stuff even when they weren't giving direct instruction. They were having casual conversations with their kids about how life is going. You know, the relationship component, building relationships, is something that I wish every teacher spent a healthy amount of time approaching. And when I challenged our teachers this year to build relationships with their kids, I gave them the rationale why. And that's because there are some kids that maybe don't have that relationship at home or don't have that support. And you may be the one reason that they choose to come to school every day. And while they may not care about themselves yet because they're young and their brains aren't fully functioning and formed, they're going to work hard because they don't want to let you down based on the relationship. So, you know, like I've already shared, I'm here because of public education, but it wasn't just the lessons that were taught. I vividly remember the names of the people who built relationships with me and created an environment where I believed in myself because they believed in me so strongly. And I worked hard and originally, not because I felt like I was going to, you know, get where I am today or even make it to college. It's just because I didn't want to let them down. So the relationship component is a powerful piece that I think is under-encouraged by leadership.
Okay. Why? I'm going to come back to your vivid memories because that lends itself perfectly to my third question. But before I get there, one of the things that I struggle with explaining, and when I talk about this with teachers a lot of times, they say, okay, great, but middle and high school teachers, we have 150, 200 kids a day that we interact with. How can we possibly, in that amount of time, the 50 minutes a period and, you know, 180 days a year, how do you build those relationships that amount of time? When you get that kind of pushback, how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, you can't worry about actually targeting every kid. You know, at our school, we've got many thousands of kids on campus. And
it blows people's mind when I say the number of middle schoolers that are on this campus.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to over 3,000 of them next year.
It's going
to
be awesome.
It's going to be glorious. It's bigger and better, baby. Bigger and better. But, you know, with the number of teachers we have, we can't possibly say that we're going to have an individual relationship with every kid. But, you know, not every kid needs that from us. But it starts with building the climate in the classroom. The same thing I tried to do with the admin team. You know, it starts with building trust. It starts with giving them an opportunity to speak. You know, it's okay if a kid wants to ask why we're doing something in class. Take the time to explain. You might be able to teach more, deeper, faster by taking the time up front to create that climate. But, you know, the way we build relationships is by asking kids how they feel, by checking on them, by reading body cues. You know, I can build a relationship with you because I see that you seem down in the morning and ask you how you're doing. And then I check on you at the end of the day because I happen to see you in the courtyard and ask you how you're doing again. You know, I've now said to you twice, hey, I care about you. Even if you didn't give me a response, you know, on why you seem down or, you know, I don't want to talk to you. You're a teacher, but I know you care. Mm. And that component in and of itself is the foundation of building a relationship. Now you have to keep doing it though. And that's, it's hard. But it's spending the time to check on kids, care about them, acknowledge their situation, differentiate, which is a buzzword that is actually possible to do.
It's a buzzword with value.
It's a buzzword with value, absolutely. You know, some kids just need a little more. And so creating that climate, if every teacher created that climate and every teacher took the time to ask kids how they're doing when something seems amiss, or if the kid comes in real happy, hey, what's going on? And they tell you that they did something good. If you turn around and said to the class, hey, little Jimmy just won the chess club competition, let's give him a round of applause. You know, that kid now feels validated. They feel like you care about them. If we did that in every classroom with every kid, you know, somebody's going to catch somebody. And then you double down with offering up clubs, offering up opportunities to engage kids, you know, before school, after school. You know, if a kid comes to you and says they want to start an anime club, let's find an adult on campus who likes anime and let's get the club going. That's another 15 or 20 kids that feel connected. And then over time, you have that culture, you have that climate, and, you know, you have relationships.
Cool. So it's not something that we're going to fix overnight, but it's that constant effort. And mm-hmm. I think that's good. I think that's important, especially, you know, when you talk about the size and the scope of this school specifically, you're right. You're not going to catch every one of them. But in addition to the 50 minutes I spend, that student also has 50 minutes with six other teachers every day.
And absolutely. And if everybody's doing it, then every kid feels supported and feels like somebody cares. They may not have a direct specific relationship with you and come to you every time, you know, mom and dad get into an argument at work about money, but they know you care. And they may have a friend or somebody that they can talk to, but it's just that caring environment that we need to work hard on in education. And, you know, right now I feel like there's a big push that's data, data, data. You know, every kid is a data point, and it's taking the personalization and the relationship component out of it. And I think we need to put it back in.
Cool. You mentioned that you can vividly remember some of the teachers that were most influential for you and built those relationships. And so that lends itself perfectly to my third question for all my guests, which is, who is the best teacher you've ever had?
Denny Bodenmiller.
You're not the first person to use his name.
Denny Bodenmiller. You know, I had a lot of great teachers. I can think in middle school. I'll name drop some of them. Millie Cobb, Sharon Bobick, Marcia Peace. I had some people who cared. You know, I can remember an elementary school principal. Her name was Miss Wiggins. She was awesome. I really loved being in her class. She made me feel important and valued when maybe I didn't feel that way about myself. You know, I wasn't always the best dressed, cleanest kid. And, you know, with her, I was just as important as every kid, and I felt just as valued. But when I think through all of the people, you know, James Coney was a teacher who really changed my life, got me into honors classes, which got me to advanced placement classes. You want to talk about a culture shift? You know, into high school, never even having been in an honors class and having a teacher say you need to be in one, and then walks you down to your guidance counselor, and your guidance counselor, B. Benjamin, changes your schedule. Man, that was a life changer. But then my junior year, Denny Bodenmiller, he was it. He was that guy who was just magical in the classroom. Granted, it was an honors class. He was just magical in the way he built a relationship with us. Dry sense of humor. You weren't sure if he loved you or was mad at you. But he had that perfect balance of encouraging you when you needed to be encouraged, but putting the hammer down when he needed more from you. And there was a personalization that existed. And this is, you know, back in the early 90s, man, when these weren't buzzwords.
Yeah.
But he was doing it. It was just best practices. And it's because of him that my writing ability became recognized. I'd already been identified as a good reader, writer, but I don't think I ever struggled in college, and I put everything back on him. You know, his ability to challenge me to think. You know, we're reading literature in his class, and I wasn't a literature guy at, you know, 15, 16 years old, but he was just a magical person. He built relationships. He told stories that had nothing to do with education. He would bring up his home life and his personal life, and never in an inappropriate or bad way, but it just made him human. And, man, I worked my tail off for that guy, and I think he worked his tail off for us. And, I think so fondly of him, you know, and having worked with him both not only as a student, but I went back to work at that high school and as a teacher, that was neat being able to work with him as a teacher and then to be an assistant principal at that same school too. You know, I got to see him from all sides, and he was just as awesome of a human being as a teacher when I was a peer and as a teacher when I was an AP. He took other teachers under their wing, under his wings. He mentored a lot of teachers. He was just, he's everything that's right in public school education. And, you know, I'm forever grateful that I hit the educational lottery the day I got placed in his class.
Yeah. Yeah. Denny was a good guy. Now retired.
Yes.
Done. Yeah,
we lost a good one.
I loved the way he left. He didn't even go to the luncheon the last day because he's like, I don't want anything. I just want to be able to walk away.
Yeah, he was probably afraid he was going to cry. But no, you know, that's Denny. He never wanted accolades. He was never a me, look at me kind of guy. Yeah, he was just everything that's right in education, man. He cared about kids, and he had standards and expectations, and he held you to them, and he called you on it when he didn't reach them. And imagine if every teacher did that.
Mm. It would be we would be having a very different discussion right now.
Absolutely.
First of all, I appreciate your time. I'm you know, this has been a really good conversation, and but before we end, just because I'm coming into this new environment and I'm with it being the summer, I'm thinking forward about where we are. And so where do you see this school and yourself in the next year? You know, we're having the same conversation 12 months from now. Where are we? What have we accomplished that made it worthwhile?
Well, first, I have to warn you, you know, your principal that you're going to, he's a jerk, so watch out for him. And the AP you're working with, watch out for her, too. She's got a bad attitude.
She's a mess. You can go back and check previous episodes to figure out what she's...
Absolutely.
What episodes were you on, Mars?
I don't remember.
Okay.
But, you know, where do I see us?
I'll add it in post.
Yeah. Where do I see us? I see us moving forward. You know, just... continuing the trend that we're on of building relationships with kids, building relationships with our teachers, celebrating our teachers, creating a climate where people want to come work, creating a climate where teachers feel supported, creating a climate where students feel supported and like they have a say in the school, man. I just see us continuing on the track that we're at, and that's believing that public school is a great institution, and it's a great place to work, and it's a place that, you know, we can make magic happen. And so a year from now, I hope we're talking about maybe not so many crappy situations with plumbing. But hopefully we're talking about the awesome time we had, how much fun we had working, go figure. Work being fun, talking about some of the craziness that happened, because when you deal with over 3,000 kids and 150 something teachers, you're always going to experience life. And hopefully we're talking about we made it through it together. We made it through it as a team, and we were successful because kids had access to rigorous courses, and teachers had access to support and good professional development. And at the end of the day, we became or were working towards being the top producer of high school ready students in the state of Florida.
I like it. It's on.
I love it.
I think it's a good place to call this.
Let's get it on.
Again, I really appreciate your time. You know, it was a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Sorry for all the boring work speak.
No, that's what this show's about. I actually thoroughly enjoy this kind of conversation, and at least 7 people listen, so they do too. So it's totally
all
fun.
7 of you. Thank you, and I apologize. I know I'm a little nasally.
I think last episode I said that there were just my dad and I were the only 2 people to listen, but now I'm going to say
hi,
that
Dad.
By now, you know, Mr. Jackson, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
No, man, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Jackson, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me for the show. I certainly knew I was making the right choice before this, but I'm even more sure now.
If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you there, as well as a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or you can check out the feedback page on my website, which gives you other options for feedback as well. And you can find that at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, set a vision and support the people around you to get there. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.